This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity. This is Lecture 9. Our last lecture began by outlining man's experiences in sleep, describing them as being, in a sense, foreshadowings of his experiences after death. The experiences through which man passes in sleep are all on the further side of the so-called threshold, to which we have frequently referred in these lectures. What I am now about to describe are real experiences which everyone has in sleep, but they do not in our earth life rise to the level of our consciousness, except through imagination, inspiration, and intuition. We must not, however, suppose that because they do not enter our consciousness, they are therefore non-existent. They do exist, and man passes through them. If I may use a symbolic picture, it is as though a man were led through a room with his eyes bandaged. He cannot see the things in the room, but he must go on. He must make the effort of walking. He may experience various things that are in the room without seeing anything. That is like what I have now to describe with respect to man's time between going to sleep and waking. As regards his consciousness, all is plunged in darkness, because it is blind to what goes on. Yet, as I have said, man does experience these things, and the effects of these experiences play a part in his waking life. Therefore, we can only understand aright what man experiences between waking and going to sleep if we regard it as the working of the after-effects of his last sleep, combined with what is accomplished by means of his physical and etheric bodies through the day. Now, when a person goes to sleep, a sort of undefined fear comes upon him. In ordinary earth life, this fear does not rise into a man's consciousness. He has no idea of it, but it is present as a proceeding taking place in his astral body and ego, and he carries into his day condition the effects of the fear he consciously felt while asleep. Were it not so, if he did not carry this fear with him to work as a force in the physical and etheric bodies, he would not be able to hold his physical constitution together, as it must be held, to enable it, for instance, to secrete salt and similar substances in the right way. The secretions necessary for man's organism are entirely brought about by the subconscious fear of sleep life. Thus, when a man goes to sleep, he first of all enters a sphere of anxiety, as I might say. Then follows a condition of soul which resembles a continual swinging backward and forward between a state of inner quietude and one of inner disquietude, so that if a man were to experience this consciously, he might suppose that he alternately sank into a sort of swoon and came to himself again. The fear produces a state of oscillation between having himself in a hand and fainting away. The third experience is that of standing before an abyss, with the ground giving way beneath his feet, so that at any moment he expects to be engulfed. You see, even here, the moment a man sleeps, the things in the universe begin to lift themselves out of the physical and to plunge into the moral sphere. For we can only pronounce judgment on that second state into which we are immersed when we go to sleep, if we realize that the working of the cosmic moral laws are just as real as are the natural laws that work on earth. We must be able to feel with the same certainty with which we affirm that a stone falls to earth or that a steam engine is driven by steam, that as man in his present earth life possesses only a certain degree of strength, he is protected by the good guidance of the universe from experiencing as yet, in full consciousness, what he goes through every night while asleep. It has been so ordained in the cosmos that even those things that shine forth to us in utmost beauty, in loveliest radiance, must be rooted in pain, suffering, and endurance. And in a sense, all that appears so beautiful in the foreground as a background of suffering and endurance. That is just as necessary a law of the universe as that when we draw a triangle, the total measure of the angles is 180 degrees. In face of this, it is simply foolish to ask, why have not the gods organized the world as we should like it to be? Existence creates necessities. This was felt to be so, even in the teaching in the Egyptian mysteries, for there they called the conscious perception of what thus takes place in sleep, fear, and the oscillation backward and forward between holding on to oneself and swooning, and, standing before the abyss, quote, the world of the three iron necessities, close quote. That was the name given by the Egyptian mystery teaching, which through an ancient instinctive art of clairvoyance still knew of such things. It taught that if a man were to enter consciously that world which he enters every night unconsciously in sleep, he would be plunged into the sphere of the three iron necessities. What he there experiences unconsciously produces in him a deep longing for the divine, which he then felt and still feels, filling, permeating, and penetrating the whole cosmos. For the cosmos itself dissolves, we might say, into swaying, weaving, moving cloud formations. In these he lives. At every moment he can feel himself living in them. But he feels as though at any moment he might sink and go under. In all this weaving and living, man feels himself interwoven with the divine essence, which interpenetrates, surges through, and moves in the universe. This pantheistic realization of God, which comes to every healthy man in his waking day life, is an after-effect, a result of the pantheistic realization of God, subconsciously experienced during sleep. Man does then actually feel this soul to be full of an inner conviction, born of that fear and faintness, an unconscious conviction, but which at the same time provides him with an inner center of gravity, in place of the outer center of gravity of physical laws. In the secret doctrine of the Rosicrucians, the pupils were taught what man experiences immediately after going to sleep. They were told of the feeling that comes over man on descending into the sphere of the three iron necessities. It was impressed on their consciousness thus: your day experiences become submerged. They are merged into cloud formations, having the power of mobility and manifesting the quality of being. You yourselves are interwoven with these cloud formations. In fear and faintness, you stand within them, over an abyss. But you will have then found that which you must now bring to consciousness within you in three words, which permeate your whole soul. Ex Deo nascimur, out of God we are born. This ex Deo nascimur, which in the pupils of the modern mysteries must be felt consciously, but which in the ordinary consciousness is still quite indefinite, is what man first experiences when he passes from the waking into the sleeping state. In the further course of these lectures, we shall see that this ex Deo nascimur also plays an historical part in the cosmic evolution of humanity. But what I am now referring to is the personal, individual part which it plays in the life of each single human being in earth life. Then, when man sleeps on further, something else sets in. The accustomed aspect of the cosmos, as seen from the earth, ceases. Here, on the earth, he observed the stars every night from a certain point of view, seeing them radiate and shine down upon him. He saw the moon and saw the sun, the effects of which were apparent to his senses. But now, at a particular moment of his sleep, the whole starry world seems to vanish from sight. The stars cease to be physical objects. And where the stars could formerly be seen by physical vision, out of their shining radiance, which itself disappears, come forth the genii of the stars, the star spirits, the star gods. The cosmos is transformed into that which is then perceptible to conscious inspiration. It becomes a speaking universe, which converses through the music of the spheres and the cosmic word. Spiritually living beings form the cosmos, instead of the physical cosmos which we see here from the point of view of the earth. Man experiences this in such a way that if it rises into his consciousness, he actually feels as though from all parts of the spiritual universe, judgment is pronounced upon what he, as human being, is by reason of his good or evil deeds. Even as regards his human value, he feels himself one with the cosmos. If, however, he were able, consciously, to experience what happens to him, in the way it is experienced by inspiration, if he became aware of this, it would at first be distracting. Man needs a guide. At the present period of humanity's development, this guide appears when a man in this earth life has established in his heart and soul a relation with the mystery of Golgotha. When in his earth life he has acquired a relation to the Christ, who, as Jesus, went through the mystery of Golgotha. The feeling which overcomes man at the present immediate epoch, I shall speak tomorrow of the feelings possessed by men in other epochs, is that his distracted soul must inevitably dissolve utterly away in the sphere he now enters, unless the being who has entered into his concepts and feelings and the very impulses of his heart, the Christ being, becomes his guide through this sphere. Here again, the feeling of the approaching Christ, who becomes our leader, and whom we must conceive in this sphere as being just as closely connected with the sun life as is man himself with earth life. This feeling of Christ drawing near to one was brought before the souls of the pupils of a mystery school of the Middle Ages in the words, "In Christo morimur," in Christ we die. One feels the soul must inevitably die utterly, unless it dies in Christ, whereby what would be the death of the soul becomes cosmic life. Thus does man enter the life of sleep, and thus does he pass through it. When he realizes that the cosmic stars are real beings, and finds himself in their unaccustomed company, then, as he cannot awake in that sphere with his consciousness, the longing arises within him to make his way back to the sphere of consciousness. That is the reason we awake. We have the feeling which again does not reach our consciousness, that on account of what we have drawn from the stars, because of what we have actually absorbed from the star beings, the star gods, we shall not wake up devoid of spirit, but we shall bring with us into the corporal day of life of day the spirit that dwells in the soul. This feeling, which in the personal experience of man in his earth life forms the third part of his night experiences, was also brought to the consciousness of the pupils in a mystery school of the Middle Ages, in the third saying, "Per spiritum sanctum revivissimus," through the Holy Spirit we come to life again. Therefore this threefold participation in the spiritual world, on the far side of the dweller on the threshold, unknown only to the man of today, must be regarded as three stages, which at the same time impress upon the human soul what we may in the true sense call the Trinity, permeating, weaving, and living in the spiritual life. Man experiences every night in pictures what I have here described. Into these pictures are woven, in a retrospective sense, the experiences which he had during the day. Just as we find our experiences here on earth during our waking life interwoven with the events of nature's processes, so in this nightly retrospect we find again, repeated in the reverse direction, what we have interwoven therein of our memories of the starry world. At first, however, all this is only seen in pictures. It can only be actually realized after man has passed through the portal of death. Here on this earth it is a moving picture, seen moving backward. It will only be realized after the completion of the 3 or 4 days tableau which I described yesterday. But it will then be a reality, not merely a picture such as we see every night on entering the spiritual world. If we wish to call before our souls, in a really comprehensible way, the events which man experiences consciously after passing through the gates of death, we must take the following into consideration. The gods, that is to say the spiritual beings we encounter, coming from the transformed stars, are following a different course from ours, as earthmen during our earth existence. I am now stating a very important truth about the spiritual worlds, and one that is not so clearly perceptible and not generally taken into consideration where the spiritual worlds are discussed in a more theoretic way. When we are conscious, we earthmen bear within us, in our earth life, a physical and an etheric body. These are so organized that the sum of our experience runs such a course that we pass from the earlier to the later ones, and find ourselves carried along a certain stream in time. I will draw this stream as a red arrow. It is the peculiarity of our physical and etheric bodies that they follow this direction in the cosmos. In this, and there's apparently a diagram, it's not in this book, red in the diagram is our physical body, and this yellow our etheric body. They are both moving in the direction of the red arrow, and our whole life, all our experience in the world, insofar as we are human beings, moves in that direction. There's a left to right. The beings we encounter when we ascend to the life between death and a new birth, when we realize what we experienced here as pictures during sleep are moving in the opposite direction, arrow from right to left, they are continually meeting us. Thus, therefore, in relation to what we in earth life call time, we must say, the gods possess spiritual bodies, bodies of light, as we may call them, with which they move from the most distant future toward the past. Thus the gods move in this other direction. Just as here on earth we draw our physical body from the physical substances, so in our passage through time between death and rebirth, we put on divine bodies. We clothe ourselves anew in divine bodies, which in my book Theosophy I have called Spirit Man and Life Spirit. Thus we ourselves, when we pass through the gates of death, put on a life body and a spirit man. And in so doing we are given the opposite course in space. Immediately after death we turn round and travel back to our birth or conception. In our life here on earth, from birth or conception, we follow this direction. And there's an upper half of a circle, apparently. And after our earth existence, we turn back in the opposite direction, lower half of the circle, to our temporal birth, to where we were conceived. It is just as though we went forth from our home to visit a certain spot and then returned, thus in a sense describing a circle in space. So in the world we then enter, we describe a circle in time, for there is no space in that world, though time still exists there. We pass forward between birth and death, and having finally gone through both those experiences, we turn and pass back through the nightly earth experiences, realizing them then as spiritual realities. We travel back along the line until we come to our temporal point of departure. We have then completed the first of the circles we have to complete after our death. Very little is said today, in this materialistically thinking age, of these circles in life, in our life as a whole. We must go some distance back along man's earthly evolution to find a language really corresponding with these actual processes in human life. If we go back to the Eastern wisdom, which was aware of these, though through a somewhat dreamlike clairvoyance, and not from such a conscious insight as we could now command, we find a wonderful expression used in the Eastern Indian wisdom. We note that this wonderful expression springs from the insight which we today could again acquire if we were to cross the threshold with real understanding. If we consciously passed the dweller and entered the spiritual world in full consciousness. When the spiritual world is put together from some theory or other, which is at least half based on reason, it is described somewhat as follows, according to the materialistic conception of the universe. Man lives. His life begins with his birth. He grows into a child, a young man or maiden, grows old, and goes on till death, and so it goes on and on. A line is drawn, which of course has no end. Everyone who understands initiation knows it is simply nonsense to speak of an end, for there is no road leading to an end. There is the road turning back into itself. The wonderful expression in which the Eastern initiates once clothed this fact is, quote, the wheel of births, close quote. Much has been said about this wheel of births, but not much at the present day to indicate the realities. We have certainly completed the first wheel when we come to the end of our stellar journeyings, to which we allot one-third of the time of our whole life. That means as much of our earth life as we have spent in sleep. We have then concluded the first wheel of birth and can await patiently, in the life between death and rebirth, the revolutions of other wheels of birth. We can only understand what has come down to us from the ancient wisdom when, through the awakening of by imagination, inspiration, and intuition, we penetrate the worlds beyond the veil of the senses, and by some such method of insight into the spiritual worlds, regain the knowledge of them possessed in olden times. This knowledge was man's legacy from the days of his association with divine spiritual beings. We then begin to feel the great admiration and wonder for the ancient wisdom of humanity, of which I have spoken on another occasion. In all that is described in the ancient records, and particularly in all that spiritual vision reveals concerning what mankind once knew, and of which a few wonderful expressions have been preserved, such as that of the wheel of births, we rise to an immense reverence for this primeval wisdom. So that really, anyone who takes into his soul the initiation of the present day cannot but look up with special reverence and veneration to the primeval times of man's life on earth. This will, however, show us something else. It shows that we can only reach the true nature of that old conception when we find it again through the spiritual science of today. Those who would exclude that can never understand the language spoken by those who possessed the old primeval wisdom, and therefore in reality they cannot give true historical descriptions. The manner in which those who wish to know nothing of the spiritual world analyze and interpret the old records of primeval peoples is sometimes childish. In the literature which perhaps contains but dim records of the ancient wisdom, ring forth such wondrous words as the wheel of births. We must learn to understand such words by rediscovering the reality to which they refer. Therefore, if the history of man is to be truthfully described, we must not shrink from first making ourselves acquainted with the meaning of the language prevalent in olden times. I might easily have begun by immediately describing the historical development of man, using expressions to be found in ancient documents. But that would be giving you words, nothing but words, such as are too frequently tossed about when these old records are mentioned. If, therefore, we wish to describe even that small part of the world of reality which man has lived through during his historical time, we must begin by describing his relation to the spiritual worlds, for only thus is it possible to understand that language and all that was done in olden times, in order to acquire a connection with the spiritual worlds. In yesterday's lecture, I described what once upon a time the Druid priests accomplished by raising the stones and laying one across the other in such a way that from the shadow cast within this structure, they could read and interpret the will of the spiritual world penetrating the physical stones. This was, moreover, connected with something else. In the spiritual world, not only is everything an entrance, but everything has also an exit. Just as the forces of time, which bear us through physical earth existence, carry us after death back whence we came, so there are also forces passing into these structures, coming from above, and others passing upward through them from below. In these structures, the Druid priests could observe an ascending and a descending stream of forces. When the Druid priests had erected these structures in the right parts of the earth's surface, not only could they perceive the will of divine spirits descending from the cosmos, but as one-dimensionality prevailed in the ascent, they could, if the structure stood in the right place, perceive the goodness or wickedness of the members of their own community who spoke out into the universe. Thus these places were also observatories to the Druid priests, in which they could see into the souls of those members of the community who were in communion with the cosmos. You see, all these secrets and mysteries are linked to that which has survived in so decadent a manner from the olden times. We only understand such things when, through the power of our own imagination, inspiration, and intuition, we raise the world of the spirit from its concealed existence into man's conscious life. Circular movements such as I have drawn, and which of course in this form are only meant to be taken figuratively, for we really move in the sphere of the one-dimensional, are repeatedly gone through by man in the course of his life between death and a new birth. Just as the circle I have drawn leads from birth and death and back again from death to a new birth, so do the other circles lead backward and forward through man's whole life between death and rebirth. But there is always a shade of difference between the outer journey and the return. Here in this first wheel of birth, the difference is that we experience the outward going part until our physical death and the other part, the return journey, in the time immediately following physical death, which measured by our earthly standard of time, lasts as long as the third of our earth life. The first wheel of birth is then completed. Others are then attached to this, and we go on with these wheels of circles until we reach a definite point from which we can enter on the return journey in the manner I shall describe in the next lecture. We go on traveling round these circles until we reach that point in our whole collective life which signifies the last death which we experienced in our preceding earthly incarnations. We spend our life following such circles, always in the time immediately after death, looking back and experiencing all we went through between our last death and the last birth into the earthly life we have just forsaken through death. Every one of these circular movements represents, in its course, a cosmic sleep. Were I to go on drawing such circles, starting here and going on further, the outward course would always represent a life after death, in which man, with his whole being, extends further into the cosmos, when he is conscious of really living in the cosmic world and feels himself one with it. The other half of the circle always represents man's return into himself from the cosmic world, when he sets to work to transform in himself what he had previously experienced in the cosmos, and to experience it in connection with himself. Just as we in earth life, if we are to lead a healthy existence, must experience the interchange of sleeping and waking, so in our time between death and a new birth, we must always experience to some extent this flowing out into the cosmos, during which we feel ourselves as great and all-embracing as the cosmos itself. We then feel the forms and facts of the cosmos as our own, and so far identify ourselves with the cosmos that we say to ourselves, what you perceived with your physical eyes while still a citizen of earth, what you then saw as the physical reflection of the cosmos of physical stars, among these you now live. These, however, are not physical stars but divine spiritual beings, which unite their existence with your own. You are, in a sense, dissolved into cosmic existence. Within you dwell the divine spiritual beings of the cosmos. You must identify yourself with these. This, in a measure, is one part of our experience, between death and a new birth. And whether one calls it night or day, cosmic night or cosmic day, we have to experience what I have just described. But the earthly expressions used to define it are, of course, a matter of complete indifference to the gods living in the spiritual world. Only, in our earthly nomenclature, we must use words which represent what we experience outside ourselves and describe this in a comprehensible way. After the time during which we grow out into the universe, so to speak, and identify ourselves with it, there follow other times when we draw back into our own self, more or less into a single point, the point of our own self, when, as in a cosmic memory, we feel all that we had poured out into the cosmos is now within us, part of our own self. In a sense, we feel this wheel of birth to be much that really is always a whirl, so that what we experience in common with the cosmos, the living outside ourself, as it were, and then coming back, and then being drawn back into ourself there, to experience the smaller third part, is constantly repeated. The self goes out again and is once more drawn back into the spiral, so that what has been described as the wheel of births may also be described as a spiral movement. I'm going to read that sentence again. So that what we experience in common with the cosmos, the living outside ourselves, as it were, and then being drawn back into ourselves there to experience the smaller third part, is constantly repeated. The self goes out again and is once more drawn back into the spiral, so that what has been described as the wheel of births may also be described as a spiral movement which over and over again draws back into itself. Such is the line of progress in self-experience and divestiture of self which is pursued between death and rebirth. This, to some extent, indicates the events in which we are concerned in our passage through the spiritual world between death and rebirth. But it is as though, in describing the earthly events occurring in the course of 24 hours, we were only to mention the fact that man sleeps and wakes. This divestiture of self, this self-withdrawal, is in the spiritual world as sleeping and waking in the earthly life of man. Just as in the earthly life of man, the events he has experienced present themselves first, so in the completion of the wheel of births and deaths, do those events present themselves which he experiences between death and rebirth. To understand these, it is necessary to have a sound conception of the position man really occupies in earth life. Man is only actually awake as regards his imaginative world and that part of the world of feeling which is connected with his concepts. When a man determines to do something, even though it be only to pick up a pencil, the intention that lives in the concept descends into his will, and the will calls the muscles into play. All that takes place before we see this concept carried out, before the hand grasps the pencil, all that occurs in earth life as manifestations of a man's will and desire, is just as much veiled in darkness, though it may occur in the daytime, as is the sleep life of man. As regards our ordinary consciousness, we are only awake with respect to our concepts and part of our feeling. As regards that part of our feeling which depends on our will, and with which we approve or disapprove what we propose to do, we are asleep. And we are also asleep as regards the will itself. We do not take our thoughts with us. We do not carry the thoughts we formed on earth into our life between death and rebirth, any more than we carry them into our sleeping life. In the life between death and rebirth, we must form our own thoughts, and they must be such as are suitable to that other world. What we do take with us, however, is what here on earth remains in our subconsciousness, our will, and that part of our feelings which is connected with the will. We live together with that of which we here in earth life are so utterly unconscious, yet which lives in our desires and passions, and in all our physical will nature. We live with these, and with all that is spiritual in our will nature, all through the time between death and rebirth. There, what we only experienced subconsciously on earth is made over to us. We become conscious of the cosmic thoughts. To understand even the time immediately following the passage through the gates of death, we must realize that although we have a great deal to go through in our souls on earth with respect to the physical body, yet the moment we cease to possess one and pass through the gates of death, our outlook becomes quite different. The physical body, comprising the substances known to chemistry, does not experience hunger or thirst. The inner experience of hunger and thirst is an experience of the soul. But the satisfaction of hunger and thirst here in earth life is accomplished through the physical body. Hunger lives in the soul, but the satisfaction of hunger here on earth lives through the body. Thirst lives in the soul, but the satisfaction of thirst here on earth lives through the body. Now, when you pass through the gates of death, you no longer have your physical body, but still have hunger and thirst. You carry ordinary hunger and ordinary thirst with you through the gates of death. The time of traveling back through your night experiences, which takes about a third of your earthly life, has to be spent in disaccustoming yourself to a sense from being, in a sense, from being hungry or thirsty, and getting rid of other cravings, which can only be satisfied through the physical body. The inner experience of this in comparison to earth life is one-third of your life. What follows afterward we shall go into later. But during this time, all that can only be satisfied through the body or on earth must be eradicated. The soul must free itself from those desires which, though they must still live within her, can only be satisfied through the body and happenings of earth. I have now told you part of what man has to go through immediately after passing the gates of death, based on what has been considered today. Tomorrow we shall proceed to the considerations of life between death and rebirth, as regards the whole development of mankind on earth. We must realize, however, what are the events which play their part in this earth life. That which can now again be investigated through imagination, inspiration, and intuition, was once possessed by man in a sort of instinctive vision. Night was not then so closed to man. His life by day was more dreamlike, and in the dream pictures more of the spiritual world was disclosed. We now live in an age, and I lay special stress on this today, for reasons which will become apparent in the next few days, we live in an age when mankind is more than ever before exposed to the danger of losing connection with the spiritual world. Penmanmar is perhaps the very place, being still so near to the sanctuaries of the old European druidic memories, in which to point out certain symptoms, not evil in themselves, but which, as such, indicate what is not only going on physically in our earth life in humanity, but is also, in a sense, going on spiritually behind the scenes. Just think of a man of what we today call the Dark Middle Ages, and compare him with a man of today. I shall only indicate two of the symptoms today which should draw our attention to the way the world should be observed from the spiritual point of view. When one takes up a book of the Middle Ages, one observes how each single letter is, as it were, painted in. One sees how long the eye must have dwelt on these letters. The whole attitude of the soul of men who thus dwelt on the written letters was then better fitted to harmonize with the revelations of the spiritual world that might come to them. Then consider the handwriting of today. It is no longer legible. There are no longer any letters in which we can feel anything like artistic pleasure. They are simply thrown on the paper by a mechanical movement of the hand. What we constantly see on writing paper almost looks like nothing. The result is that we are beginning to write, not for the purpose of communing personally with our fellow men, but using typewriting machines through which we enter into no sort of personal living relation with our correspondent. The motor cars are symptoms of much the same kind of thing. By means of all this, we can see what is going on behind the scenes of existence, and how man is being driven further and further away from the spiritual world. You must not think I am standing before you as a reactionary, wishing to banish motor cars and typewriters or even the dreadful handwriting. Anyone who can fathom the way of the world knows that all these things had to come and are quite legitimate. What I now say must not be taken as meaning that they should be abolished. I refer to the attention and care that is given to them. They had to come. We must accept them, even as we must accept day and night. But the enthusiasm for these things may lead to a one-sided attitude in persons who have a strong leaning to the material world. All that is entering the world in this way, making such dreadful headway in the illegible handwritings, and such a dreadful hubbub in the typewriting machines, and which rushes so terribly through the world in the motor cars, must be counterbalanced by a strong penetration into spiritual knowledge, spiritual feeling, and spiritual willing, if man is to develop in a healthy way. There should be no question of fighting the material, but rather learning to know it in its true reality, of understanding it, but also of seeing how necessary it is that what will otherwise crush humanity out of physical existence should be counterbalanced by strong spirituality. Then, through the swing of the pendulum between typewriters and motor cars on the one hand, and on the other the imaginations, the insight into the spiritual world created as a result of the world of spiritual science, the healthy development of humanity may be promoted instead of being damaged. This is what I had especially to say in Penmanmar, that this is a place where, on the one hand, such legacies still remain from the times of the old Druids, as the imaginations, which, as I described, remain stationary, while on the other one experiences how enormously these stationary imaginations are disturbed by the atmosphere of the rushing motor cars. The end of Lecture 9.